the second series of Shoftim, of judges of the Jewish people, as recorded in the Tanakh, are some of the most interesting and perhaps the word is different people that we meet in the Tanakh. As I explained to you regarding the period of the Shoftim, the Jewish people are basically in turmoil and chaos. It is a time when there is no central government. It's a time when not only are the tribes separate, but that the tribes of Israel war with themselves. We have quite a number of civil wars that occur during the time of the Shoftim. Tribe against tribe, Jew against Jew. And it's not just the usual fractiousness of the Jewish people that we don't get along with each other as we should, but here you're talking about actual war. We're talking about blood and casualties and death. And the Jewish people are beset by various enemies on the borders of Israel and within the heartland of Israel as well. There is a slow reinfiltration, so to speak, of the enemies that were driven from the country. But now, after the period of a few hundred years, when the Jewish situation has not yet stabilized, so then it is inviting for foreign tribes to come, to invade, to persecute, and to try and exploit the Jewish people. So at the conclusion of the previous lecture, I discussed with you the war of Dvorah and of Borak that defeated Sisera and Yovin, the king of Canaan, the king of Chatzor, and that gave the Jewish people 40 years of peace, a respite of 40 years, which is a long period of time of peace. It's a long period of time of peace for the Jewish people. It's a long period of time of peace anywhere in the world. Till our time, for instance, there has not been a 40-year block that Europe has gone without a major war since the beginning of history in Europe, since the 10th century. In our time, if we discount the revolts in East Germany and in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, which were not really wars, potentially Hungary, they could have been wars, but they were not. But if we discount that, then you have the longest period of time that there has not been a war on the European continent in perhaps a millennia. And therefore, we don't have a war because of the mutual balance of terror. But in the history of the Jewish people, 40 years is a very long time. And for peace, it's an enormously long time. After the death of Dvorah, the fifth judge of the Jewish people was a man called Gideon. Gideon, the son of Joash. And he was the judge of the Jewish people for 40 years, approximately from 1084 before the Common Era to 1044 before the Common Era. Now, at the time of his reign, the main enemy of the Jewish people was east of the Jordan, and that country was Midian. Midian is well known to us in the Tanakh and in the Chumash. Yisro came from Midian. Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, Moshe Rabbeinu's wife, was a Midianite. And the Midianim were warlike people who participated in wars against the Jewish people at the time of Moshe. In fact, the war of Elazar and Pinchas was against Midian. And revenge of the Jewish people was against the Midianim because of the fact that they used their women to seduce the Jewish people and bring about the death of tens of thousands of Jews. Midian here makes a comeback. 300 years later, it comes back again. And the strength of its comeback was based upon a very strong military group and on the fact of the absence of Jewish strength. And the Midianim began to infiltrate from east of the Jordan across the Jordan River. You can see in all of Tanakh parallels to the types of situations which pertain today in the Jewish world, and especially regarding the land of Israel. They were able to infiltrate across the river. They were able to capture Jews, to kidnap Jews, to extort money, to engage in all of the time-honored practices of terrorism. We like to think that terrorism was invented in our time, that it is a 20th century phenomena. But that's not true. Kidnappings, ransoms, all sorts of barbaric terrorist acts are part of the story of human civilization almost from the beginning. And description in the Talmud of the behavior of Cain or the behavior of Esav is basically one of this type of terrorism, extortion. It's not a 20th century invention, and that's one of the types of naivete which exist in our time, is that we always think that this is new, it's something that never happened, and the PLO is a new organization. The PLO is very old. It goes under different names. In the time of the Tanakh, it went under the name of Midian. But it's the same guys, the same tactics, the same goal. Personal gain, exploitation, wealth, power, and the destruction of the Jewish state. That's what the Midianim stood for, and that's what they attempted to perpetrate against the Jews. Jewish people are defenseless. Their great judge, Dvorah, has died. Baruch is dead. There is no one to defend them. And now the Lord appears to Gideon, who was a farmer. And the angel of God appears to him as he is pressing his wheat, threshing his wheat, rather, in the threshing floor. And the Ribbono Shel Olam tells him, Gideon, you're my man. You're going to save the Jewish people. There's a famous couplet that says, how odd of God to choose the Jews. Well, in the Tanakh, we can say the same thing, Kaviochel, if one could say it, but how odd of God to choose the types of Jews that he chooses. Because the people that become the Shoftim, all of whom are moved by divine spirit, all of whom have a level of Ruach HaKodesh, of divine spirit, of the Holy Spirit within them, are not, as portrayed in the Tanakh or in the Talmud, necessarily the top echelon of the Jewish people spiritually or in their behavior. And therefore, that leaves open to question why, you know, how out of God, how strange it is that these are the people. But God has many messengers, and God does things his way. And they were the right people at the right time for the right events. It could very well be that people who were, blasphemous or sacrilegious, but it could be that people that were more spiritual or more holy couldn't have done it. Because this takes tough people, this takes people with a certain amount of, I wouldn't say callousness, but with a certain amount of strength to be able to do things that under ordinary circumstances are morally repugnant and are not nice. And Jews are always troubled when things are not nice, but the world is not neat. And it doesn't always fall into nice categories. And as the great biblical scholar Leo DeRocher said, nice guys finish last. And the Jews can't afford to finish last, because if we finish last, we don't finish. And the Tanakh points that out to us in all of its bitter truism, and all of the difficulty that's involved. So Gideon takes a very small army, an army of 300 men, and he chooses the 300 by seeing how they drink water. Those that prostrated themselves on their knees to drink the water, so that showed that they were pagans. They were accustomed to bow down in that fashion. and he didn't want them. He got 300 Jews that drank water by crouching, not by bowing down. And he chose those 300 Jews, and he outfitted them with a type of psychological warfare and secret weapon of torches inside of bottles. It's the first Molotov cocktails in the history of the world, just to show you how relevant the Tanakh is. And what happened is that they fall on Midian in a surprise attack, and 300 are able to destroy thousands because the panic is so great, and the feeling of being surrounded, the fear of the unknown, the new weapon of the fire, all overwhelms Midian. We find the same thing with our father Abraham, that when he pursued the kings, so in the Chumash it says he had 318 men, but the 318 men were, in fact, the rabbis even lower than 318. They say it was Avram and Eliezer alone, because if you add up Eliezer's name in Gematria, numerically it equals 318. So a small number of people are able to overcome large armies. That is not an exception in the history of warfare. Sparta in its time was a small nation, but it was able to govern most of Greece because of the fact that they knew how to use their men and their weapons most efficiently and most effectively. And the rallying cry of Gideon and of his men was Cherev LaHashem uLeGideon. The sword is on behalf of God and on behalf of Gideon. And Gideon proved himself to be a fearless warrior. He proved himself to be a brilliant tactician. He was not afraid to take on Midian, and he was not afraid to take on any of the enemies of Israel. Because of that, Gideon is the right man. Because of that, Gideon is the great man, the man that the generation demanded and that the generation received. And Gideon is the person who has miracles happen to him, the sign with the dew on the wool. And Gideon is the man that is able to stabilize again the Jewish state and to defeat Midian and to bring back a modicum of stability to the Jewish people. He also had a great family. According to the Tanakh, he had 70 sons. 70 children. He had many wives, although they will all come to a tragic end by one of his children, not from his wife, but from his pilegesh, from his concubine. Not from one of his official wives, but from a wife whom he married, and he gave birth to a son called Avimelech, whom we'll discuss in a moment, and Avimelech, and today we would say the middle child, right? Avimelech, the unwanted child, the one that came. So he takes revenge. He kills his 70 brothers to make sure that there is no disputation. The Tanakh's view of sibling rivalry is very real. And it does not end, you know, just with toys or the ninth grade. But it's something that people live with their entire lives. And here Avimelech, the son of Gideon, is out to prove himself, and his first step in proving himself is killing his brothers. Gideon is also called Yerubal. That's another name that's given to him in Tanakh. And he's called Yerubal because of the fact that he broke the Baal. There was a great altar to Baal in the northern part of the country. Baal was the chief Canaanite deity, the chief Canaanite idol. And he broke it, he destroyed it in his loyalty to God. He's also called Yerubosheth. And the Talmud also tells us that during the time of Gideon, the study of Torah increased, and that the Bezdin of Gideon, the Bezdin of Yerubal, his court, and when the Talmud talks about a court, it doesn't mean the judges. It means the yeshiva of his time. It means the houses of learning of his time were equal to the houses of learning that existed at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. So you have here this rare quality of the man who is the hero, who is the warrior, who is the organizer, but who also is able to fight the battle of God, so to speak, and to raise the educational level of the Jewish people so that in his time, his schools, his yeshivas, his institutions are comparable to the highest time that existed in Jewish life. And Gidon is a fascinating, one of the fascinating vignettes, one of the fascinating characters that appears in Tanakh. He died, I mentioned that he was the shofet for 40 years, which also was a long period of time, and afterwards, his son Avimelech became the shofet. He killed out all of his brothers except one. One brother, Yosam, was able to hide and was spared the sword, but everybody else was destroyed. Because he was because he behaved in such a fashion, he was not the most popular man in Israel. And the Jews did not want to give him the leadership. He prevailed on the people of the city of Shechem. Shechem, which is today the city of Nablus. Nablus has always been trouble to the Jewish people. Our rabbis say Shechem is Mokom Muchen Leperonius. It's a place where there's always trouble, as we can also well testify to today. And Shechem, Yosef was sold, and Shechem, the kingdom of Israel, divided from Judah. In Shechem, there was the idolatry. Bad things happened always in Shechem. The people who lived there, Shechem was one of the cities of refuge, one of the six cities of refuge. And it always had a bad press, and deservedly so. So he prevailed on the people of the city of Shechem that they should join him, and they appointed him to be the judge. They were the spearhead of the drive to make Avimelech the judge. But what happened is that after 3 years of Avimelech, even the people of the city of Shechem had enough of him. He was a tyrant, he was a murderer. According to the Radak and others, he never got over being the illegitimate son, or not the illegitimate son, that's stated too strongly, but not the son of an official wife. And he had that rage within him, that anger within him. There are certain people who are angry people, and an angry person is very difficult to deal with. An angry person who comes to power, watch out. That is tough. Wilhelm II, the Kaiser of Germany, is a prime example, but there are others. Angry people, frustrated people, people with handicaps, people with psychological handicaps, those are the wrong people to have as the leader. And Avimelech put down the rebellion of the people in Shechem, and he put down the rebellion of the Jewish people with tremendous terror and brutality, and he burned the people of Shechem alive. He incinerated the city. Well, as you can imagine, this is an open invitation again for the enemies of Israel to start again, because every time the situation gets stabilized, then the Jewish people tear it up from within, and they tear it up from within, then the enemies from without are ready to pursue the matter again. We never have a shortage of enemies. Never. Our rabbis characterized Avimelech in very negative terms. The rabbi said, Avimelech lo hoyu lo ma'asim tovim. He never had any good deeds. In other words, the bad joke, well, tell me about his good qualities. And the guy says, I'm thinking, right? It's hard to come up with good qualities. Avimelech, usually Chazal always find some redeeming features in a person, even in the worst of people, even in terrible Rishoyim. But Avimelech, Chazal almost write him off. Lo hoyu l'masim tovim. He had no goodness within him at all. And the Medrash in Shoftim says it even more strongly, that the Rabboni Shalom said, Avimelech Rosha, you murderer, you killed 70 of your brothers, you who killed the city of Shechem. Like there's almost no hope for you. He was assassinated finally. He only was a judge for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, a woman threw, as he was riding through the town, a woman threw upon him a metal part of a chariot. She pushed it off the roof and it hit him. And he splattered all over the place, and that was the end of him. And he was assassinated. We are not told in the Tanakh where he was buried, if he was buried. I mean, he was just bad news. So here you have, as you oftentimes have in history, and we'll have it many times in the Tanakh, a good and righteous father. In fact, a father who is the savior of Israel, and who is a person that reestablishes the supremacy of Torah and morality, and he has a son that undoes everything that he accomplished. And his son does it with a vengeance, as though to get even with his father. We'll see the same thing regarding Chizkiyo HaMelech and his son Menashe. Menashe was the king of Judah for 55 years. Chizkiyo was the great tzaddik, the great man of the generation. Menashe undoes everything that Chizkiyo accomplished. The educational system, he reinstates idolatry. He does everything possible to undo what his father wanted. There is a man in the Tanakh called Bidon. Bidon is mentioned in Tanakh as a man that saved the Jewish people. There's a difference of opinion in the rabbis who Bidon is. The opinion of Rashi and most of the Mefarshim is that it was Shimshon, and he was called Bidon because that's Ben Don, from the tribe of Don, which was the tribe of Shimshon. But the Septuagint says that he was Baruch ben Avinoam, that he was Baruch the general that fought with Dvorah. And he was also one of the great leaders of Israel, but he was not officially a shofet. He was never officially elected to be the judge. So Gidon was the fifth judge and Avimelech was the sixth. Now we have a series of judges about whom we know nothing, because the Tanakh, when it wants to, and Jewish history, when it wants to, is very selective. It's like, Franklin Pierce, or Millard Fillmore, or Zachary Taylor, or other great presidents of the United States whom we know nothing about and we're not really interested to know much about. So, Lahavdil, you find the same thing in the Tanakh. The Tanakh tells us about people and then tells us nothing about them. And to compound the matter, the rabbis tell us nothing about them. They're like not mentioned. It's as though they didn't exist. And in the historic records of the times, we find very, very little, if anything, about them. There's archaeological evidence to Gidon and to Avimelech in Shechem. But the next judge, who was the seventh judge, is a man called Tola ben Pua. And he was a judge for quite a period of time, 23 years. And we know where he is buried. He's buried in the tribe of Ephraim in a village called Shamir. That the Tanakh tells us. But what he was and what happened and where he came from, no one knows. And the period that he flourished and that he was powerful, we know very little about that period also. We don't know about what was the internal condition of the Jewish people and what was the external condition, what the enemies were trying to do. It was like an interregnum between the great Shoftim, between Gidon on one hand and between those who are going to come after him, especially Shimshon. The eighth judge, after the 23 years of Tola, was a man called Yoyir HaGilodi, Yoyir from Gilod. And he lived in the northern part of the land of Gilod. Gilod is, again, east of the Jordan River. Gilod is just south of the Golan Heights, south of the area called the Golan. It begins in the plains of Gilod It's today northern Jordan. Northwest Jordan is the Gilead. The only thing we know about him also is that he had 30 sons, the Tanakh tells us, and that the 30 sons had 30 special donkeys. You know, like we would say his 30 sons rode around in Porsches. Or Acura Legends or whatever you want, you know, whatever your flavor in cars is. They were the ones that ruled it. And your Agilodi had 30 cities, and he called the cities Chavos Yoyer, the suburbs, the areas, the provinces of Yoyer. Now that's a play on words, because the original Chavos Yoyer is mentioned in the Chumash, that Yoyer ben Menashe, Yoyer, who was the grandson of the descendant of Yosef, when the Jewish people defeated Sichon and Og and took over great chunks of territory east of the Jordan, preparatory to their march into the land of Israel. So individual Jews went and conquered cities and conquered areas. One of the areas was Yoyer. One of the great warriors, the conquerors, was a man by Yoyer, and he called the cities, rather, Chavos Yoyer. And here, Yoyer Agilodi also calls he had 30 cities, and he named them the same Chavos Yoyer. He was the judge for 22 years. So you have a period here of 45 years, really 48 years, between the time of Gidon and between the time of the next great judge, who is Yiftach. And that 48-year period is marked by the fact that we know almost nothing about it, that half a century. We don't know the struggles, we don't know the internal struggles, we don't know the external struggles. We have almost no external evidence of the time. It's not written in anybody's history book. And the Tanakh is purposely vague and quiet regarding it. And not only is the Tanakh vague and quiet about it, the Talmud, which usually fills in the gaps in the Tanakh, the Talmud here purposely tells us nothing about it. So it's left in that status. It's left as a period of time that existed, but what existed and how it existed, we don't know. Yoyer was the eighth judge. The ninth judge is a man called Yiftach Agilodi. Yiftach was a judge for only 6 years. But he was a great and strong person, and he made a profound influence on the Jewish people and upon all eternity. He also has a checkered past. Chazal generally say that all leaders have to come, in the words of Chazal, have to have a kupo shel shrotzim. Al shichmo, they have to have a skeleton in their closet. We don't want a perfect leader. God save us from that, right? Jimmy Carter. We don't want to have someone that's, you know, super moral, super holy, because then you can't deal with him. He's not human. And people who are above humanity are subject to making terrible, terrible errors of judgment. They're also subject to being terribly cruel people. So we want to have, in the words of Chazal, someone that has a kupo shel shrotzim al shichmo, you know, like David, like other one. You know, we can say, are you so and so? You saw, you know, your father was in jail? Is that the one? Yeah, oh yeah, and I know you. Right? Years later, he was a smuggler. Yeah, sure, oh. That's how Chazal characterized it. That's the kind of guys we like. It's very strange, but it's very telling. David HaMelech, he said, oh, you know, your Boba was a Gioras. I said, was she a kosher Gioras? Are you really Jewish, David? Well, could be, maybe. They ever pasken that child? So he had to behave himself, David. couldn't be above anything. They said about Moshe, oh, Ben Amram, oh, you know, where were you when we were suffering in Egypt? Where were you all the years? What happened to you? Oh, you were the king in Ethiopia. Yeah, oh, that's nice. We were here taking it on the back, and you were, yeah. Everyone in Jewish life has a kupa shel shvatz. And that's not meant to be understood in a negative term. That's a positive viewpoint of leadership. What is the famous legend about Warren Harding, that when they offered him the candidacy to be president of the United States in 1920, and Harding was a drunkard and a profligate, and he was, you name it, he was it, corrupt. So they said, can you think of anything that would prevent you from being president of the United States? So he went into a room by himself for a half hour, and then he came out and said no. And his administration was plagued with scandal, ridden with corruption. So that's overdoing it a little, right? You can't, you know, there's a kupo shel shrutzim, but nit the sheretz alein, right? A box with shrutzim in it, but not that he should be himself the abomination, the rat. But Yiftach is that point himself. Yiftach, it says that he was a ben isha zona. His father was Gilad, and his mother was someone of questionable repute. How his father and mother got together is a source of conjecture, especially in folk legend, you can imagine. And he had brothers, and the brothers of Gilad from the official wives, they kicked him out. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. They disinherited him. They said, you're not a legitimate son. You know, you're our father's accident. We don't want to have anything to do with you. And Yiftach leaves, in the words of Tanakh, and he goes to Eretz Tov. He goes to the good land, right? He goes to Las Vegas, to Atlantic City. He goes, you know, they don't want him, right? They kick him out of the yeshiva. So good, so he's going. And he had his friends, Anoshim Pochazim, very, very loose friends. He didn't hang around with the best group. Anoshim Reikim, empty people, people with no purpose. But what happens is that the Jewish people now come again under terrible, terrible external pressure. Again, from the eastern side of the Jordan River, from the country of Bnei Ammon. Ammon, that's the city of Amman today, the capital of Jordan, Rabat Ammon. And they are the children of Lot. They always were the allies of Midian. Midian usually was stronger than Bnei Ammon. Midian had been irrevocably defeated by Gideon, but now Bnei Ammon rises to the top. And they come with complaints. And the complaints are the Jewish people stole our land. 400 years ago, they came and took away our land. Called an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. I mean, you see, if a person knows Tanakh, Tanakh is not a book of history. Tanakh is today's newspaper. And he comes with Tinus, you know, he's legitimate. He represents the legitimate interests of Bnei Ammon. These guys took our land. Who gave them the land, right? And he wants to redress the balance. He wants to undo the whole 400 years. And Yiftach sends him messengers. He negotiates with him. He says, where were you for 400 years? And all of a sudden, what do you want us to do about it? And maybe we can settle this. And the Talmud tells us, maybe you'll take money. And oh, no, that's it. We want the legitimate rights of the people of Bnei Ammon. We want it. That's all we want. Now, Now, the Jewish people are hard-pressed. They have nobody to lead them. And they don't feel very confident against Bnei Amon. So they go to get Yiftach, because Yiftach is a great warrior. And Yiftach has got a bunch of bums around him, right? Who're going to be good now, right? They were going to, the dirty dozen, we could use them. And Yiftach says, okay. He said, what do you want from me now? He tells him straight, what do you want from me now? You guys kicked me out. You said, you know, I'm no good. Now you need me. Go get a different boy. So Yiftach makes an agreement with them, and you see the humanity of the agreement. You can empathize with it. He said, listen, after we win the war, I'm going to stay as the king. You're not going to get rid of me. I'm going to remain as the shofet. I know what you guys want. You want me to go, and I'll win the war and everything, and then the next election, you'll kick me out, which is what always happens, right? Winston Churchill saved England, and as payment, they voted him out in 1945, right? The guns weren't even cool yet. So he said, you're going to get rid of me. I don't want that. So the elders of Gilad, of the Jewish people, said to Yiftach, Hashem yieh shomea benoseinu im lo chidvarecho kei naaseh. As God listens to our words, so shall we do. They have nothing to worry from us. We're going to behave ourselves. You win, you're the man. You're the shofet in peacetime, not just in war. Because it was better to be the shofet in peace than in war. And Yiftach saw it that way. Yiftach is a man of impetuosity. And Yiftach is a man of deep faith. He has a deep abiding faith in God. And he makes commitments to God. It's almost simplistic how he deals with God. You know, you do this for me and I'll do that for you. Now, one can deal with God that way, but you have to really mean it. It is a certain level of almost quid pro quo behavior, which we find in the Talmud and rabbinic literature at times very justified. So Yiftach tells the Rabbonu Sholem, listen, the first living thing that comes out of my house when I come home, I will sacrifice to you if you will only be with me in the war. And Yiftach wins the war on a very, very grand scale. He destroys Bnei Amon, also a remarkable victory of arms, one that's completely unexpected. And he comes home in triumph, and the first thing that walks out is his daughter. And here the rabbis give us an insight. The high priest, the head of the Sanhedrin at this time, was Pinchas, the son of Elozer, the great Pinchas HaKohen. Pinchas had within himself the ability to be mater nader, to annul the vow, because he could have called him and asked him, if you would have known that it was your daughter that was going to walk out of the house, would you ever have made that commitment? And he would have answered, certainly no, and that would have been the Pesach, the door to get out of the neder, to annul it. But Pinchas said, I'm going to go by him. He needs me. Let him come by me. If he comes by me and asks me, I'll be glad to get rid of it, but I'm not going to him. Yiftach, who was the judge, the shofet, said, listen, he knows I'm in trouble. He knows I need rabbinic advice. If the rabbi really cared for me, he'd come over to my house. I'm not going to him. He should come to me. So our rabbis say that between the two, the child died. Enormous insight again into people. Because each of them looked to their honor and to their status, and they didn't look to the child. They would have looked to the child, and they would have saved them. And our rabbis tell us that they were both punished. severely punished. Pinchas no longer had Ruach HaKodesh. God departed from him. The great Pinchas that the Ribbono Shalom said about him, V'nasati lo esbrisi shalom, I give him my covenant of eternal peace, the great symbol of the Jewish people, God cut him off. And Yiftach, the Talmud tells us that wherever he went, he suffered from a type of leprosy that literally limbs fell off of him. They atrophied and fell off. So the Talmud tells us that he's buried all over Israel. Wherever you went, there was a piece of him. In Yiddish, we say, gefallen sticker. Pieces fell off of him. And that's the tragedy. He was only the judge for 6 years. But he was undone. He was undone by his impetuosity. He was undone by his ignorance of the law. And he was undone by his own hubris, by his own arrogance and pride. He had to prove the point that he was the king. Yiftach also made a civil war with the tribe of Ephraim, because the tribe of Ephraim threatened him. They said, you didn't allow us to share in the booty, etc. You know, there's nothing like not participating in a winning war. Before the war starts, not everybody's anxious to go. But once you win the war, then why didn't you call me to the party? And they threatened him, and they said, we'll assassinate you, we'll burn your house down. And he went to war. 42,000 Jews died in that civil war, to show you what a time it was. Terrible, bitter time. And our rabbis commented that Yiftach wasn't really a Talmud Chochem. Chazal call him Kal Shebakalin, the lightest of the light. But nevertheless, when God needs you, so even the lightest of the light is the one. He serves the role that God wants him. And it is regarding him that the rabbis say the famous comment, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Yiftach and his generation served the purpose that the great Shmuel served in his generation. Even though between Yiftach and Shmuel, there is absolutely no comparison in stature and greatness and in the aristocracy of the person. But Yiftach in his generation was what Shmuel was in his generation. Our rabbis meant to tell us by that, I feel, that had Shmuel lived in the generation of Yiftach, he would have been useless. In the generation of Yiftach, Yiftach was the right man, not Shmuel. In the generation of Shmuel, Shmuel was the right man. There's times and circumstances, events, that all of which serve to shape the history and to shape what happens. The 10th judge of Israel was Iftson, whom we know better as Boaz, the husband of Ruth. He was the 10th judge of Israel. He is from the tribe of Judah. And he was the judge for 7 years. The last 7 years of his life when he was an old man. It's a fascinating thing, a tragic thing, but he had 30 children, all of whom died in his lifetime. And the only one that survived was this child that he had from Rusa Moaviah at the end of his life. It was the gift that God gave him, but that was the gift of immortality. Now, rabbis always say the rule that a person should have children at whatever stage of life he is in, because one never knows which is the child. One never knows where one's future really lies. Boaz was already a great and good person. He was called the Tzadik Ador. He's mentioned that way in the Medrash. And Boaz was Mechadesh Halochas that we have from Boaz. And the greatness of Boaz, again, in his 7 years, was that he raised the level of learning, the level of education amongst the Jewish people. After Boaz, there comes another judge who is not known to us. Elon HaZvuloni, Elon from the tribe of Zvulun. So he's already the 10th judge, and he was a judge for 10 years, and again, we know nothing about him except where he's buried. He's buried in Elon, in the land of Zvulun, which is near Haifa, but we don't know anything about him, and the Talmud doesn't even mention him. And the 11th judge also has the same silent fate. We've seen that this is already the third judge out of the 12 that we've discussed. Fully one quarter of the judges are not mentioned. We only know again that he was the judge 8 years, and it says also that he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, and he bought for them 70 special camels or donkeys to ride upon. The Tanakh always tells us about that because, again, in their age, it was what the car is to us, what the automobile. It's more than a means of transportation, right? It's a statement because it was only a means of transportation. Cars could not be merchandised the way they are, and they would not command the prices that they do, and they wouldn't have the importance in life that they have in American society. To us, an automobile is a statement about us. And in the time of the Tanakh, the donkey was a statement. So the fact that the Tanakh describes it for us in that detail and puts that emphasis on it is to point out that problem. He was he's buried also in Piraton in the land of Ephraim. And again, he is another judge whom we know nothing about. So you have four out of the 12 that we don't know anything about. That brings us to the 13th judge, who is probably the most difficult to characterize and the most difficult to understand. During his reign, and this is the great Shimshon HaGibor, 22 years he was the judge of Israel, the Plishtim, the eastern border, quieted down. Now the western border heated up. The Philistines came back with a vengeance. And the Plishtim now will remain the main enemy of Israel for the next 100 years. Our friends in the Gaza Strip. Same people. And the Plishtim came and marauded and raided, and the Jewish people were unable to deal with them. And they were unable to deal with them militarily, they were unable to deal with them socially. And in a religious sense, the Plishtim undermined the Jewish people. They brought the worship of their gods, of Dagon and the other gods, into Jewish homes. They had a great effect. Probably the Plishtim had the greatest effect of all of the foreign tribes on the Jewish people. Shimshon is born miraculously. His mother was a woman who under ordinary circumstances could not have borne children. His father was Manoach. The angel appears to Shimshon's mother and tells her that she's going to have this great son and that he should be set aside. He should be a Nozir, a Nazirite. He should never drink wine. He should never cut his hair. He is set aside for a holy purpose for God. And he is the supreme example of a Nozir. Because the ordinary Nozir, or the usual Nozir, was a Nozir for 30 days. The Talmud says, Nozir Shimshon. A Nozir such as Shimshon is a Nozir his entire life. Never cut his hair, never drank wine, never became Tomei. That all of that was part of the vow of Naziris. And as he grew up, it says, Vatochel Ruach Hashem Lefamo, within him beat the Spirit of God. He was a great person, and his greatness was to try and save the Jewish people. V'hu hochel lehoshia, he began to save the Jewish people from the hands of the Philistines. Shimshon, though, is a one-man operation. Whereas the other judges were able to organize it, Shimshon has no allies. He has no friends. He really has no basis in Israel. It's only Shimshon. But Shimshon is Shimshon HaGibor. He's the legendary hero, the strong man of the Jewish people, the one man that we would like in our corner in any contest. And the Tanakh tells us legendary feats of bravery and of strength. He rips the lion in half. He is able to slay many, many people with the jawbone of a donkey. The astute observation of an English minister that the jawbone of an ass has slain many, many a person. Probably referring to rabbinic sermons. Shimshon has within himself the quality of saving the Jewish people. However, we see within him certain characteristics that are hard for us to deal with. His first wife is a woman of the Philistines. And then he has the famous story of his marriage to Delilah, who was also a Philistine woman, and she was treacherous to him. She's the one who informed upon him. And with her wiles, she is able to weaken him. She shaves his head while he is asleep, and God takes away his strength as punishment. And with him dies the Jewish hope, because he did not, as I mentioned before, train any infrastructure. He did not create anyone that would survive after him, that would be able to establish a strong Jewish state. It's a one-man show. That's always the problem with one-man show. With a one-man show is that it's one man. And since everyone is mortal, so eventually the one man is insufficient. And when Shimshon is arrested and captured and blinded, so then the Jewish hope of salvation is blinded with him. The Jewish people can't imagine how they're going to get out of it. And the hand of the Plishtim is very strong against the Jewish people. To a great extent, during his reign, the Plishtim become the masters of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people have to pay tribute. They have their foreign policy, so to speak, is under the influence of the Plishtim. They are not independent any longer. But at the end of his life, Shimshon takes revenge upon his enemies. He is blinded, and he is forced to pull the wheel of the threshing floor, but his hair grows back. He regains his strength. God gives him his strength once more for one great defiant act. And his words are the words of defiance that echo throughout Jewish history. Tomus nafshi im plishtim. Let me die with the Philistines. I'm going to take them with me. I make peace with my death, but I'm not going without them. And in the great temple of Dagon, where tens of thousands are gathered to celebrate the feast day of the god, he pulls the pillars down, and the great stone building collapses and kills thousands of his enemies. And so that's the lasting triumph of Shimshon. Shimshon eventually triumphed over his enemies. And that phrase, as I mentioned, repeats itself throughout Jewish history. Tomus, there is a strain within us that's called Tomus Nafshi im Plishtim. And we're not going to let them get away with it. All right? If we go, they go too. And the Jewish people are very good at pulling the plug. I think that's part of the fear of the world regarding the nuclear capabilities of the Jewish people, is that the world is well aware that there's a certain radicalism within us, and that they will not go quietly. They will not die so that the rest of the world can survive. That's not part of the Jewish makeup. And that's Shimshon's heritage to us. He's given us that quality of Tomus Nafshi im Plishtim. The last of the judges was Eli HaKohen, the last of the judges before Shmuel HaNovi, whom I'll talk about next time. Eli HaKohen. the great Cohen Ely. Ely was the judge for 40 years after Shimshon, and he lived to be 98 years old. We even know that he was born on the 10th day of Iyar. That's his yahrzeit. And he was a Talmud of Pinchas, and he also was a Talmud of Shimshon. Shimshon had a great Bez Din. He had a school of learning that was highly accepted. And he also is a person of great stature. He is descended from the Kohen Isomer, Itamar, a Kohen not from Elozar. Until then, all of the high priests had been from the third son of Aaron, Elozar. He is the first of the high priests to be descended from the fourth son, from Isomer. And it will not be until the time of Shlomo HaMelech that the high priesthood will revert back to the family of Elozar. For the next number of generations, it will be the family of Isomer. He had two sons, Chofni and Pinchas, which we find again in Tanakh, that example of sons that undo their father, who did not behave correctly in the Mishkan in Shiloh. Ely was in Shiloh. Shiloh came to its height and glory at the time of Ely, but it was also destroyed in the time of Ely. And his two sons were part of the breakdown of the system and the breakdown of the society. Father is very, very hard-pressed to hear negative things about his child, and there was no way for him to control the situation. The family of Ely suffered a curse, and the curse remained for almost thousands of years, that those that are descended from the house of Ely did not live long. They had short lives. And the Talmud tells us that they found in the time of Yochanan ben Zakkai, they found members of the family living in Yerushalayim, and they came and they said to him, what can we do to live longer? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Isku b'Torah v'chiyu, that you have to devote yourselves to Torah. You have to have a greater schus than others, because biologically you're not going to live long. The Gemara tells us about Abaya and Rabbah, who were also descended from Ely, that one died at 50 and one died at 60. And because one of them was more Osek than one that lived to 50, so he was Osek B'Torah. So Torah got him to 50. He should have died 30. But Torah got him to 50. And the other one was Osek B'Torah, B'Gmilas Chasodim. He had not only Torah, but he had good deeds as well, so that got him another 10 years. But whatever it is, their family was doomed. Their family, it was almost a genetic trait within them, that they did not live long. And during his lifetime, the Jewish people went to war with the Philistines, and they, in order to assure themselves of victory, they took the Oron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark of Moshe, with the Luchos, they took it to war with them, which was against the Halacha. Ely was powerless to stop them. And they took that with them, and they lost the war, and the Ark was captured by the Plishtim. And the Plishtim didn't know what to do with it. Wherever they put it, they had problems with it. You cannot have the Ark in your house and behave like a Philistine. It doesn't work out that way. So their idols were broken, their buildings collapsed, people died. So the Plishtim said, take it back. All right? Who needs it? It was too expensive a trophy. It had too many dangers associated with it. And they gave it back, and we'll see during the time of Shmuel and the time of David, they had a hard time finding Jews to house it, because there are problems. You know, if you have it in your house, Jews have Sifrei Torah in the house, etc., it's a responsibility. I was once in a house, I saw a guy had a Sefer Torah in an Oren, and under the Oren he had his television set. Now that's really risking it.
Public broadcasting,
undoubtedly. Even public broadcasting. But the problem of Ely, is recorded in all of its tragedy. And when Eli heard the news, so when he heard the news that his sons were killed in the war, so even though he was stricken by tragedy, he was able to accept it. But when he heard the news that the ark of the Lord had been captured and was now in the hands of the Philistines, he fell off of his chair and broke his neck and died. And that was the end, the tragic end of the old man Eli. But Eli had raised a child that would be the savior of Israel. When the prophet Shmuel was 3 years old, he came to live with Eli. His mother brought him to Eli, and Eli was his Rebbe. And if he did not see his vindication in his own natural sons, he would see it in his student, in his protege whom he raised, who in the eyes of Chazal was the equal of Moshe and Aaron, one of the great men of Israel, whom we'll talk about next time.